Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Old School Labs. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk about the history of bodybuilding, and we also talk to the bodybuilding legends themselves. And I am your host, John Hansen, and happy July. We are now in the month of July, second part of 2019. I apologize. This episode is coming up a little bit late, but I was out of town over the weekend, so it's going to be a few days late this week. And on today's show, we have an interview with Ruth Silverman. And Ruth used to work for Flex Magazine, and I met Ruth at Ironman Magazine, where she was working for John Balik. And Ruth's specialty, of course, was covering all the women events, all the women bodybuilding competitions, and then as that expanded into fitness, Ruth was an expert on all that. So we were going to start a new series on women's bodybuilding, but unfortunately, I haven't really gotten any interviews yet. All the women I've reached out to have not gotten back to me. So we only have this interview with Ruth. So we are going to run this episode today. And in the future, if we get any more interviews with the women, we'll run those. But me and Ruth talked about sort of the history of women's bodybuilding, when it started, and how the look of female bodybuilding changed from when it first started to obviously now. And actually, women's bodybuilding has kind of been phased out for women's physique. So we're going to talk about how that all occurred and what happened. So it's going to be an interesting interview with Ruth. She's a very intelligent and opinionated woman, so she's going to have her views on it. And I think you guys will enjoy this episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we switch gears a little bit and talk about women's bodybuilding. And I want to mention that we are brought to you by our consistent sponsor, Old School Labs. I've been with Old School Labs for several years now. This is the supplement company that draws on the wisdom of the golden era of fitness and bodybuilding to offer unique supplements for the discerning athlete. Old School Labs is the only brand that I use, trust, and associate my name with, and it's the brand I used to win the Natural Mr. Universe contest in 2012. You may have heard of their award-winning fat burner, Vintage Burn, which is the world's first muscle-preserving fat burner, or Vintage Blast, which is their two-stage pre-workout, or Vintage Brawn, which is the triple protein isolate powerhouse. It's packed with eggs, milk, and beef protein. Their products have no proprietary blends, no artificial flavors, colors, or sweeteners. Old School Labs is also the home of 1983 Mr. Olympia Samir Banoot and bodybuilding legend Tom Platz. So use the discount code LEGENDS12 and you will get 12% off your order at oldschoollabs.com. Old School Labs, supplements that make sense. All right, and as I mentioned, I just got back from Chicago today, from this morning, and I was out there over the weekend to celebrate my cousin's son's wedding. Patrick got married to his fiance Kate, and they had a beautiful wedding, and I wish them all the best. It was great to go out there and see my family. I only get to see them usually twice a year now, usually around Christmas and maybe one other time, so it was really, really good to go out and see my parents again. And my brother and my sister and everybody in the family, and then all my cousins. And then this weekend, I got a chance to go over to Glenn Kinnear's house. Glenn, of course, is the 1986 AAU Mr. America. We had him on the show a couple months ago. And, man, I haven't seen Glenn in probably 20 years. So I went over to his house and hung out by the pool, and we talked about bodybuilding. So that was great. And then I got to see my friends Nick and Al and my other friends Amit and Dennis. So it was great catching up with all my old friends. These are guys that I've known probably 30-something years, 35 years. So it was great to catch up with all of them. It's hard to stay in touch with your friends as you get older because everybody goes their separate ways and everybody's so busy. But it was great this weekend catching up. And another thing I did while I was at my parents' house was I have all my old bodybuilding magazines in their crawl space. And I've got boxes and boxes of these things. I go from way back from 77 when I started bodybuilding. So last night when I got home from dinner with a couple of my friends, I got on my hands and knees and I crawled into this crawl space, which is all concrete, so it was killing my knees. But I had to grab some magazines so I could share them with you guys on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. So I was able to get into a box that had a bunch of old Ironmen from like 76, 77, 78. So today, after we have our interview with Ruth, I'm going to read an article about the 1977 Mr. Olympia. This is the contest report of the 1977 Mr. Olympia contest written by Roger Schwab, a frequent contributor to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. We've had Roger on probably at least four or five times. And this is the January 1978 issue. So Roger was the head judge of the IFBB back then, but he also wrote articles for Ironman. And I remember him from when I used to read these articles when I was a kid, because they were great, great articles. And you guys are really going to enjoy this one. He goes over the whole contest and he gives the contest report. And this, of course, was Frank Zane's first Mr. Olympia win. So stay tuned after our interview with Ruth. You're going to love this article. And I got some sad news in the bodybuilding world just a couple days ago. I saw this on Facebook or on social media when I was out of town. Kent Keen, his last name was spelled K-U-E-H-N. I'm sure a lot of you in the bodybuilding world know of Kent. He was featured in the book and the movie Pumping Iron. He was a frequent training partner of Arnold. In fact, I think you can even see him in the background when Arnold is walking up the stairs in that 1974 Mr. Olympia pick. And Kent was a manager at Gold's Gym for many, many years. He competed in a lot of those IFBB shows in the 70s. He was featured on the cover of Muscle Builder magazine one year. He was also in the movie Stay Hungry, along with Pumping Iron. So he was a big guy in that bodybuilding scene, you know, in that old school bodybuilding scene, the golden era. Kent was around during all that time. And he just passed away, I think, a couple days ago. Sean Ray posted it on my Facebook page, and I think Jerry Branham told Sean about it. And I think when I talked to somebody recently, they said Kent was in a wheelchair, so it sounded like he wasn't doing that well. So unfortunately, he did pass away. So all our condolences to Kent's friends and family. He was really, really loved by the bodybuilding community, because on Sean Ray's post, there was a lot of people saying how great Kent was to them when they went to Gold's Gym, and how he let him work out for free, and he always made him feel good. So Kent was a really great guy. And I met Kent also at the 1992 Natural Mr. Universe contest, which was the first Natural Universe contest that I won. And that was the first year that I competed in the ABA competition, or the organization. So it was a whole new organization for me. This was the natural organization that's based out in California. Now they're called the INBA, but back then they were called the ABA. So I went out to San Francisco and I won the Natural North America. And then about a month later, I went to California and competed in the Natural Mr. Universe. So this was in Southern California at Venice Beach High School. And I didn't know anybody out there. I went out there by myself. So I had nobody to talk to after the prejudging was over to find out how I did or how I looked. And it's hard to tell how you look compared to the other competitors when you're on stage with them. You can't really tell. So anyways, Kent was the expediter backstage, as he was in a lot of shows in California. He was frequently a judge or an expediter. He came up to me backstage as I was waiting to go on stage, and I was waiting in the wings. And he goes, "Man, your physique reminds me of Mike Mentzer." And I go, "Hey, didn't you train with Arnold?" And he goes, "Yeah, yeah." So I got a chance to meet Kent. So it was great. I understand what all these people are saying about what a great guy he was, because here I was out there by myself, unsure of how I was going to do in the show. And then he told me that I had a physique that reminded him of Mike Mentzer. So, of course, that made me feel great. And then I went on to win the contest. So that's my experience meeting Kent Keen. And he was always at the Venice Beach contest that Joe Wheatley holds every holiday over the summer at Memorial Day and 4th of July and Labor Day. He will be missed. Rest in peace, Kent Keen, a real golden age bodybuilder from the golden era. Also, this last weekend, we had a bunch of birthdays. Rachel McLish celebrated her birthday, which I think I mentioned last week. Lance Dreher also celebrated his birthday. And Lance was just recently in the hospital for congestive heart failure. But I believe he's out now and he's doing well, because he responded to everybody, because I posted that on Facebook and everybody was concerned. So I guess Lance is doing pretty well now. It was also Tom Platz's birthday. And I believe Lance and Tom were both born in the same year, 1955. They are getting up there, but they're still with us, and they're doing good. And I'm glad Lance is out of the hospital. So happy birthday to all of them. Also, happy birthday to Rachel McLish. And also, it was Frank Zane's birthday. a couple days ago, and Frank is 77 years old. So it's hard to believe. I saw Frank when he was 35 when he won that 1977 Mr. Olympia. How fitting that right after his birthday, we're going to read this article about him winning his first Olympia in 77. And believe it or not, it is now our anniversary, second anniversary. We started our first show for the Bodybuilding Legends podcast on July 4th, 2017. So we are now going on 2 years. I can't believe it. I thought the show would only run for about a year. I didn't think I'd be able to find any more interviews after a year trying to interview some of the old school guys. But believe it or not, we have lasted 2 years now. So we are headed on to our third year. I don't know how long we'll keep doing the show, but I hope you guys appreciate it. And it's always great to hear from you. So I know I got a big fan base out there. I don't know how many people are listening, but I know I do have a big fan base out there. People like me who love hearing the old bodybuilding stories and hearing from the legends of bodybuilding, which I believe, in my mind, that was the best period of bodybuilding. And I think a lot of other people feel that way also. All right. And we did get a few comments on our interview last week with Stan Morey, who was the AAU judge. And Stan had some controversial things to say, but we did get some comments on my Facebook page. Artie Lamparella said Jim Haislop was the best of his era. He had everything to challenge the best. Shame he quit so young. I guess Artie was just looking at the picture and not really talking about the actual interview we did. Robert David said, this was a great interview. I enjoyed listening to the stories, especially the politics that went on. Joe Weider was a real cutthroat businessman. However, he did help popularize bodybuilding. Frankie Albert said, great pictures from the past. All these guys look phenomenal. But Tom Platz being thrown out of a gym, say it ain't so. Robert Telkachov said, Richard Baldwin is always great. So I don't think a lot of those comments were about the actual interview. I think they were just commenting on the picture I put on Facebook. And then my friend Pete Fancher said, I cannot wait to give this one a listen. Stan was a great influence on myself. And Pete, of course, was one of the judges from the Florida area. He was in the Central Florida District where I am. Pete was a judge for a long time, and he was probably a young man when Stan was judging the shows and promoting the shows. And then Pete said, I just finished listening to the interview. Another great job, John. And it was really special hearing Stan talk about those times in Florida and how things were done back then. Stan helped me considerably in my early competitive days, and I was always thankful that he took the time to do so. He was a driving force in the early days in the mid-70s in Florida, and it's a shame how he was treated. Too bad the sport has such a corrupt history. And Richard Baldwin, who is a friend of Stan, actually got Stan to do the interview, said Stan was largely responsible for removing bodybuilding contests in Florida from an afterthought to powerlifting contests and being produced in a gym with opposing light thrown over the basketball hoop in auditoriums. And he always had top bodybuilders like Frank Zane, Boyer Coe, and Arnold Schwarzenegger as guest posers. Stan also made sure the competitors received outstanding trophies. I started publishing the Florida Bodybuilding Association newsletter, and I refused to cover any contest that didn't follow Stan's example and allow competitors to see the judges' scores after the contest. The latter helped curb the cheating that was going on. And then Pete Fancher replied, Richard Baldwin, so true. I remember vividly a few shows starting after the lifting and the single light over the basketball hoop. Unbelievable that he used to actually do shows like that. And we did get a negative review, Pat Neve. He did not like the interview at all. He said, sorry, my friend, that was the worst interview ever. What a horrible representative for our sport Stan is. He slandered everyone in our sport. So that was our comments on the Stan Morey episode. So if you guys have any comments or if you have any suggestions on any future guests or anything you want to hear on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, you can always contact me at naturalolympia@gmail.com. All right, so that is it for our opening. Here is our interview with Ruth Silverman, where we talk about the history of women's bodybuilding. I hope you enjoy it. Here we go. All right, welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And my special guest this week is Miss Ruth Silverman. And Ruth used to write for, I believe, Flex Magazine. Correct, Ruth? That's when you started?
I was the associate publisher of Flex Magazine. I was
associate publisher
for about almost 2 years.
And then you were at Ironman Magazine?
I was at Ironman Magazine for almost the better part of 30 years.
Wow, 30 years.
I worked
That's
for
crazy.
John Balick from 88 through about 2015 when we sold the magazine. Well, so he sold the
almost
magazine.
Right at the very beginning then.
Yeah, they had just purchased Iron Man from the couple that had started it in 1936. Iron Man really was the oldest bodybuilding magazine. They bought it right before I came on board, because when I worked at Flex, John and Mike had just left. John Balick, Mike Nephew, had just left and bought Iron Man. John used to come around every month to show us all his issues, and that's how I met John.
So
it was really cool. And to be honest, at that point at Flex, I had started working with Rick Wayne.
Mm-hmm.
Just basically, I was an editor who got a job.
Okay.
I was an editor, and my girlfriend was the managing editor of the magazine that later became Men's Fitness. It was called Sports Fitness then.
Mm-hmm.
And I filled in for her while she was on maternity leave, and I just kind of stayed on a part-time basis.
Okay.
And we were sitting there in the offices right outside of Joe's office. This was before they completely redid that building in Woodland Hills. So we were putting out this whole magazine in a little cubbyhole. And at Flex, you had Rick Wayne, the former bodybuilder, and he was putting out Flex like he called like the People magazine of bodybuilding. He really is into the personalities and the romances and the other things, in addition to writing about the muscle.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just sitting there one day, and Ricky, who I'd never spoken to more than once, basically said, how would you like to have Jerry Candela's job? Jerry Candela had been running Flex for him, and Jerry had left to go take another job, and what they were doing to fill the gap was not working. So Ricky came to me not knowing that I had higher editorial experience than what I was doing. Offered me this job, and I said, cross my palm with silver. I was about ready for a full-time job at that point. I said, cross my palm with silver. And so the next thing I knew, I was the editor and then the editor-in-chief of Flex.
Okay.
And about halfway through I came in the middle of 1986. The first issue my name is on is January of 87.
Okay.
And I worked with Rick for about half the time, and then Ricky left to go back to his native St. Lucia and become a journalism magnate. And Bill Reynolds, who was an established veteran at Weider, had been promised the editor-in-chief position, which I had that title at the time. And Bill came on board, and somehow I managed to get Joe Weider to give me a better title than Bill's. So he was the editor-in-chief, and I was the associate publisher, and we were having a great time. I was working with Ed Passarelli, who was the art director, and we had a fine time, and I learned all about bodybuilding. It was just cool. It was new. I knew nothing about it when I got into it.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that.
Not a damn thing. I mean, I had not been an athlete since intramural basketball in high school. And
where did you go to college?
I went to Northwestern.
Northwestern, Chicago, right?
That's correct. Although Northwestern is very famous for its journalism school. However, I graduated from the theater department.
Oh, okay.
And then I knew that I was going to be a writer by the time I got out of college.
Okay.
I knew I was not going to be an actress, you know, but I knew I was. That's how I found out what I did best.
Mm-hmm.
And the job at Flex was not supposed to be a lifetime career, but I was having too good a time.
Yeah.
And then I lost my job at Flex, let's just say politics, and Mr. John Balick kindly offered me a little writing, a little editing, and then 27 years later, we sold the magazine. What can I say?
Right.
I loved working at Iron Man because we were a small group.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody did everything. So I didn't just write. I got to write and be a line editor. Plus, we all did it like desktop publishing. So I also learned to be an art director.
Mm-hmm.
So I would do layout. And by the time I was doing my gossip column, Pump and Circumstance, I pretty much did the layouts for my column and also for the News and Views column. What you may not know is that when I was at Flex, and Ricky Wayne used to put out a gossip column called Muscellaneous.
Mm-hmm.
And when he left it, where there was a hole. And somehow I just filled it. So for a year, I wrote the Muscellaneous column at Flex. before I moved on to Ironman. So that's okay. My history. I'm just a girl who got a job. And then I've got to get it. It has to be interesting for me.
Yeah, yeah.
It has to. I mean, because I could have gotten a much better paying job editing computer manuals. That was big then. But, like, who wants to do that?
Yeah, right.
I mean, people do, but it does not suit me. So this free-for-all, this sporting, half sports reporting, half technical thing on the exercises, you know. When you think about it, I've been editing exercise articles for more than 30 years. I know a great deal.
Yeah. So what did you think about bodybuilding when you first started working at Flex?
Well, you have to know that my previous job was as the copy chief of Hustler magazine.
Oh, so really?
Going from porn to bodybuilding was not like I was doing something outlandish. And as my mother said, you got to eat.
Right.
Nothing ever did offended my mother, which was pretty cool.
So did it take you a while to learn about the sport and, like, who the top people were and how they judge these contests and all that?
It took a while. I have a memory of Mr. Jim Mannion, who, of course, was very close with Rick and later very close with John Bailick. And I have a memory of I would go to I sent myself to contests to learn. Okay. Mm-hmm. The first I got, so it was summer 86 when I started. I remember going to the Los Angeles Championships at the same Culver City Veterans Memorial that we go to now for shows. And that was my first bodybuilding show. And I remember that Mae Mollica, Rick's wife now, who wrote for us then, I remember her advice to me. She said, whenever you see a physique that looks like you like it, look down at the legs, then you'll know. So I learned very early not to be impressed by just a set of shoulders and biceps.
Right, okay.
So I remember being at a show once with Mr. Mannion, and I asked him a question that showed him I understood the politics that was going on. And he did a double take, and he looked at me and he said, you used to ask stupid questions. Meaning I had asked him a smart question.
Right.
Rather than the beginning. So I took myself to shows. I took myself to New York. The Miss Olympia at that time was held at the Felt Forum of Madison Square Garden.
Right.
That theater has another name now, but then it was the Felt Forum. So the first professional bodybuilding show I saw was Corey Everson's third win for Miss Olympia 1986.
Okay.
And that was just amazing. Because that was the heyday of the celebrity that came off of Pumping Iron 2.
Yeah.
So you would go to the Felt Forum and Andy Warhol was there. And all kinds of, you know, all kinds of celebrities who were not from the bodybuilding world necessarily. And it was just fabulous.
Yeah. So when you first got into writing for Flex, had you seen the original Pumping Iron with Arnold? Had you seen that? Did you know? Because in the 80s, bodybuilding was really very, very popular with the mainstream. I remember a lot of Hollywood actors were working out. Gold's Gym was really big at that time.
I had not seen it, even though I am a film fan.
Mm-hmm.
But early on in my tenure at Flex, the Flex gals, as we called ourselves, because there were a bunch of women in the art department, and I brought on one of my best friends as an editor, and also another gal. We had a party at my house, and we screened both Pumping Iron films that night. So that was my introduction. We did it all at once. But before I came to talk to you, I did watch Pumping Iron 2 again, although I've seen it several times. It had been a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really astonishing to find out that the conversation that was going on in 1983 when they filmed that was still going on in 1986 when I came on board, and in fact is still going on today.
Oh, really? Huh, that's interesting.
How much muscle?
Right.
I admired them. I find I admired everybody. First bodybuilder I ever interviewed was Bev Francis.
Okay.
Who is the star of Pumping Iron 2.
Mm-hmm.
And her husband, Steve Weinberger, came to the Flex offices, and I did an interview about her nutrition, what she ate.
Okay.
And it was just, you know, I don't know why it was a natural fit, but somehow I stuck. I was having too good a time.
So let's talk about pumping iron too, because I want to talk about the women of bodybuilding and, you know, your unique perspective from that. You got into it. You got into working for Flex a couple of years after that movie premiered. So
Correct. You
said that, as you said, the debate was, if you go back to the beginning of women's bodybuilding, 1979, 1980, I think it was kind of, it really caught on with the public. And I remember the mass media was really all over women's bodybuilding back then, because I think it was unique that we had women who had muscles. Because I remember when I started bodybuilding in the late 70s, people would ask me occasionally, can women build muscles? And I'm like, no, they can't build muscles because they don't have the hormones to have that. So then when women's bodybuilding started in 1979, 1980, and they started having competitions, it really took off. And I think a lot of it may have been just because it was the curiosity factor. Wow, we've never seen this before. We've never seen women on stage posing their muscles. So when that really took off, the women, as you said, they weren't really that muscularly developed. If you look at them now, you know, if you go back now, you know, almost 40 years later.
Yeah, if you go back now, you can see your average television star is as ripped as Carla Dunlap was,
if not
more. I have a different perspective because, number one, I'm a woman and I came in as a civilian, but an open-minded civilian. And number two, I don't know how to say this, John. I'm a feminist. So to me, the scene in Pumping Iron 2 that stuck out the first time I saw it and stuck out when I watched it this weekend was those withered old men deciding what was feminine and what was not.
Right, and that was the whole central part of the movie, right?
Well, that's the central theme of the movie.
Yeah.
But it's also, to me, the central, it's the crux of everything. That guy, Oscar State, I did not know him, the gentleman Oscar State, but I did know Ben Weider, who looked a lot older there. Because he looked older than Joe in the movie, because Joe had his hair dyed, although Joe was the older brother.
Okay.
So just those three men, older men in suits standing there discussing feminism is so distasteful. to me, because Bev had the best personality, that's why they made her the star of the movie.
Yeah, and she was the most muscular.
Even though she was the most muscular, and she was the seven-time world powerlifting champion that Wayne D'Amelio, I think, had kind of invited to join this because they needed a plot.
Yeah,
so she became the plot. Everybody's worried, can I stand on stage next to this big muscular woman and who actually may have had a shred in her arm at that time? It's also interesting having them talking about definition and cuts in those bodies that had never seen a cut.
Yeah.
I mean, you compare the discussion of cuts when you're talking about early women's bodybuilding to the discussion of cuts about Lee Haney, let's just say, who was the reigning Mr. Olympia when I got in. You're using the same words. You're sort of talking about the same thing, but you're not talking about the same thing.
Yeah. And in the movie, Charles Gaines, who was the author of the book Pumping Iron, he was, I believe, one of the judges, and he was questioning those judges, Oscar State and Ben Weider, and he was saying, well, who are we to determine how much muscle a woman can have? And I think he sort of equated it to other sports where preventing a woman from running faster because she's a woman, you know, and he was trying to say, where's the line? Where do we draw the line? You know, just because it's a woman, can't she have more muscle?
They still don't know where to draw the line.
Right.
And obviously the sport has changed, and the introduction of things that make the physiques larger. I know you want to talk about that. Well, who was your favorite? Who was your favorite in the Pumping Iron movie? Pumping Iron 2.
Yeah, I just watched it again also. I think, I agree with you. I think Bev came off the best. They made her, you know, they always had her family around everywhere she was at. Her family was there, so she was really
like, Carla's family was with her too.
Yeah, her mother was. Yeah, that's true.
I think that Bev had that natural joie de vivre. She had a natural personality that the camera loved.
Yeah, she was very down to earth.
And had she been a different person, the movie may have come, the contest might have come out the same, but the movie might have been different.
Mm-hmm. I was watching it again. I hadn't seen it in a while. It was sort of funny seeing the Laurie Bullen, how they portrayed her, you know, with her husband being the stripper and stuff. And then she was crying during her workouts. You know, he was pushing her so hard. I don't know if that was made up for the movie.
I also could only notice, because in preparation for this, I took a trip down memory lane through all the flexes that I had worked on.
Okay.
You know, through, like, I think August 88, I think, was the when I left there. And who was the hot thing? Well, you know, there's Rachel with the guy she was dating in the movie. Three years later, she's on Matt Mendendahl's arm, or he's on hers, I'm not sure. And so this, Ricky used to write about this always in his miscellaneous column about that, you know, Rachel and Matt were here, and they were the golden guy of bodybuilding, and then Bev and Steve, because they became a couple, you know, obviously. Mm-hmm. And so that was always, and then, of course, Gladys Portuguese, who is in the movie but doesn't really have any lines and doesn't get a lot of credit.
Except for the shower scene, she was talking in there.
Oh, yes. Well,
I was surprised to see that. I hadn't seen that in a while either. I forgot about that scene.
Yeah, I had too. I just remembered the music so much. You know, all that 80s music.
Yeah, early 80s, yeah.
So it evokes a period.
Right,
let's just
for sure.
Say. Yeah. And of course, all the hair.
Yeah, right.
The mohawks and the things. Everybody had the hair.
Do you think Rachel was portrayed unfairly? I think she said that she thought they did a, you know, they sort of painted her as like the villain, you know, a real bitchy person, you know, who's more concerned about
it. I didn't. Actually, I thought the setup was that Bev was supposed to be the villain, the big muscular gal.
Right.
But she had such a great personality. No, I actually thought she was treated unfairly. All the BS about her suit.
Yeah.
And they're probing. She's got to take the first. They didn't like the spangles. Okay, well, she probably should have known the rules there. And they kept rejecting her suit ahead of time.
Yeah.
They don't do that anymore.
Right.
They don't make you come to the opening of to check-ins at a bodybuilding show and pull out your suit to make sure it's regulation.
Right.
So they didn't like her suit. It was it was too shiny. And they didn't like her other suit. And then she brought a very plain black suit to wear on stage, which she managed to come up with.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were concerned that it was padded.
Right, right. I remember that.
That she was unaware of this because it just wasn't really padded. It was just some material there so you couldn't see her nipples.
Mm-hmm.
And so then they definitely took points down off of her for the suit.
Oh, really?
That's part of the plot. They all discuss it. And then she comes in third for that reason. Also, she may not have been at her best because you also see her a little dehydrated, or she ate some sugar beforehand, mistake, you know, mm-hmm. drank some. You would know more about that than I would do what drinking orange juice would do to you right before you got on stage.
Yeah.
So, It's interesting watching it again,
mm-hmm.
especially as it's so hard to find.
Yeah, yeah. You said it was on YouTube. That's where I saw it, too.
I found it. I found a good copy on YouTube, but I started watching one that was terrible, so I had to, like, go back.
Okay.
Anyway, so what else would you like to know about the wild and woolly mid-80s of women's bodybuilding?
So when you got into it and you saw Corey win her third Olympia, how much more muscular were the women then than what they were in Pumping Iron 2? That was
it's
only a 3-year
difference.
It's
interesting because when you see Corey from 2 years before, 3 years before that, her body looks exactly like the women in Pumping Iron 2.
Yeah, I remember. I used to see Corey compete in the Chicago area because she was from...
She's from Wisconsin.
Yeah, she's from Wisconsin.
Well, she'd been in school at Wisconsin. She's actually from the Chicago area.
Yeah, she is. And Jeff was from Wisconsin. But I used to see them compete in the regional level shows all the time, the Midwest and, you know, the Midwest Open, the Central USA.
Yeah.
So I had seen her compete. When I was a teenager, I saw her compete.
Then you know that no one ever had a structure like Corey Everson.
Right, right.
It was just perfect. she had more muscle, she had more definition than Carla did or Rachel did in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
More like what Bev looked like. So it's what, 3 years later when I saw her?
Yeah, 3 years later, yeah. From 83
well, remember, she had 3 more years of training.
Right.
With a power lifter, Jeff Everson.
Right.
And so they were bigger, but not as big when I started watching it. So Corey was the queen, but there were women with more muscle coming up. Ellen Van Maris comes to mind. She had a much harder look.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she came in a second a couple of times. Corey's genetics always carried her through.
Right.
Even in the years that she was maybe not as well conditioned as she had been. Because a more perfect genetic specimen does not have to be ripped to shreds to beat the ripped to shreds gal or guy who doesn't have the genetics.
Mm-hmm.
I can only remember the early first pro Ironman, Michael Ashley and Sean Ray. Sean Ray is going to beat Michael Ashley, even though Michael Ashley is more ripped.
Right, because he had a better
Because
start.
Sean Ray has a beautiful body.
Right.
So that's always kind of the way it's been.
So you're at the Felt Forum in 1986, and the place is packed, and you've got mainstream celebrities there. So women's bodybuilding was super, super hot at that time. Were the
Extremely.
Women... Were the women much less muscular than they would become later on?
For the most part.
Okay. I mean, what was...
Yeah, because
why do you
it
think
grew. Women, it grew. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Why do you think women's bodybuilding just took off like that? I mean, when you look back at it now, it's just absolutely amazing the media coverage it got. Do you think it was just because it was the, you know, the novelty of women having muscles for the first time?
I think... When you started bodybuilding as a kid,
mm-hmm.
John, when you started training and then all of a sudden you start to see results, right?
Right.
And you go, wow. Well, that happens to women too.
Mm-hmm.
They start, oh, wow, oh, wow, oh, wow. And if you were into it, you didn't think having a little biceps was not feminine. Most of the original women's bodybuilders had come from, were athletes.
Mm-hmm.
Came from other sports. And nowadays, of course, people go to the gym and they start to train. And then in like 6 months, they're in a bikini show. And that's very different in its way.
Mm-hmm.
It's very different. I think it was popular because women enjoy working out and getting stronger just as much as guys do. Nobody ever thought of it before.
Well, why do you think the audience loved it so much? I mean, you're packing the Felt Forum at Madison Square Garden, and you're on CBS television and NBC television. At one point, I think they did a live show of the Miss Olympia. Remember when Bev got beat by Linda
Oh, you
Murray.
Mean when Bev was winning after the...
Yeah.
When Bev was
yeah.
winning after the judging, and then when we came back, Linda Worry won because NBC didn't want a big
right.
muscular woman
right.
to be...
And that was
not
live.
To knock NBC or anything, but... I actually was not there for that show, but I watched mm-hmm. it on TV, and I'm very aware of it. And I feel that the sport organization, even as they encouraged the muscle, when it came down to something like that, they said, oh, here's what we don't want. They had to make a choice as to how to represent.
Right.
You know, and so the choice was Linda Murray, a beautiful girl who had been a professional sports cheerleader,
mm-hmm.
I believe, over Bev Francis, the power lifter. Bev's physique went back and forth over the years. It went from being really big, and then she would, after the pumping iron, she toned it down to try to be more, I don't want to say feminine because I know that would offend her. But so you can see when you go through the magazines of that era, you can see Bev looked one way. She
mm-hmm.
looked a little feminine. Then she said, the hell with this. I'm going to do what pleases me. When you're used to being a champion, you want to be a champion, right?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So I used to have this conversation with my old boss, John Balick. Mm-hmm. And he was around from the beginning of women's bodybuilding, and he objected when the physiques got large and when perhaps there was pharmaceutical assistance happening.
Right.
And he would say to him, remember, I'm just coming from a different perspective because I'm not a guy. And I have certain political perspectives on it. And he would say to me, what was she thinking when she made herself, whatever person they're talking about, and this is a generic comment. He would say, what was she thinking when she let herself get that big, or she let that guy, her coach, make her get like that? And I would say, I'm going to clean this up from what I said to him. I said, John, she was just not thinking about making you happy. So they're not, when women started to do that, they stopped thinking about, this is how I'm going to walk in high heels and be sexy. This is how, you know, it says I feel good. I'm going to get stronger. They just weren't thinking about that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he would make another argument about the men who coached them. And see, I'm speaking for him. He would make another argument about the men who coached them and what they wanted and what they liked. But I see women as mostly being dealing with their own free will about it.
Okay.
You know? Although I'm sure that's not always the case. It certainly was with the champions that I dealt with. Do you think that Bev Francis was saying, I don't want to get any bigger, and Steve Weinberger was going, no, get bigger, get bigger. No, she liked it. She was strong. She was a power lifter.
I guess what I'm getting at is, you know, how do you judge the sport of women's bodybuilding? I just had your good friend Lonnie on with Peter McGuff, and we were talking about, do you think bodybuilding is going to go back more towards rewarding shape and symmetry, because we just had Sean Roden win Mr. Olympia, and, you know, we were talking about that. And then the point I was trying to make was, if you go back to the 1980s and you've got guys like Frank Zane, Muhammad Macaway, Samir Banute, Lee Labrada, mm-hmm. they're winning shows over guys who are much bigger. And Lonnie was saying, well, like any sport, time goes on and the guys are much bigger now. And then my argument was, well, does that mean they're better? I mean, why were the judges who were rewarding these guys, the smaller, more symmetrical guys, they were letting these guys win titles. They were rewarding these guys with contest wins over bigger guys like Joseph Wilkosh, Bertel Fox.
Right.
At one time, Lee Haney lost to Muhammad Macaway several times. I mean, why were these little guys allowed to beat the bigger guys? And the judging standards had to be different, right? We're looking at judging the physiques more on symmetry and shape and muscle mass, but it was all, you know, the total package. You had to have all of that. And if the guy had muscle mass, but he didn't have the shape, he didn't have the symmetry, then he was marked down for that. And then somewhere along the way, now the freaks are being rewarded. And I doubt if a guy like 188-pound Samir Banute could go into the 2019 Mr. Olympia and win, even if he was perfect, because they would just say he's just too small.
Well, first of all, you're talking about now a sport where it's not just men's and women's bodybuilding. There are four or five sizes of men's divisions that you can choose from.
Right.
And you would have to say that men's classic physique would be closer to those bodies that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got men's bodybuilding, then you've got 212, and then you've got men's classic physique, which they should call classic bodybuilding, but that's my opinion.
Yeah,
Sean Roden beat Phil Heath, two bodybuilders who have great aesthetics in addition to size.
Mm-hmm.
Phil Heath was not exactly a block of boof. You know, he had a great grace. He has a great grace to his body.
Right.
He has symmetry. He has proportions. He's just bigger. Just went to the California Championships with the men's pro show. This guy, Patrick, who won, can't think of his last name, beautiful aesthetic physique.
Yeah, I saw
nice waist, nice taper.
Yeah, gorgeous. Real good abs. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, really. And I guess I had seen him last year, and I didn't think he finished high enough, because I'm a sucker for a symmetrical V-tapered physique. I always preferred Flex Wheeler to Dorian. So you're gonna find that answer for me, but I can tell you that that lineup was full of a lot of men that had a lot of muscle but no grace.
Right.
So this guy was, he stood alone.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that. I just saw a video on YouTube today from Jay Cutler, and Jay does this stuff where he has his friend follow him around, you know, sort of like a day in the life of Jay Cutler.
And
Dave Borlée. So they went to Muscle Beach, and they went to the show, and then they went to the contest, and Jay went backstage. And as he's walking around, I'm noticing, okay, all these guys are big, and they're all their stomachs are sticking out. Then he went to the guy who won, and I go, that's the only guy with abs. And it turns out he was a winner.
Oh, yeah. Well, I actually discussed this with Lonnie after the judging, and I said, that guy's going to win, right?
Yeah.
Because sometimes the judges surprise me. You know, goes, oh, yeah, he's going to win. And he certainly did. Now, how he'll stand on stage next to Sean Roden, this guy ever gets to stand on stage and get compared to Sean Roden, then the weaknesses in his physique are going to show up.
Yeah.
You know how that goes. You can only, and that's where it goes to where you're saying, why did they start picking these instead of these? I will give you the line that every judge in the NPC IFBB will give you. They can only judge what's in front of them now. So if so-and-so has a bigger body and he's got a lot of muscle, and the other guy has a little better shape, but he's just not ripped enough. There's that line where ripped enough to beat him, not ripped enough to beat him. You know what I mean?
Well, what
so
if
they're
going
to go, if the more symmetrical guy is not really quite in condition, the bigger guy's going to beat him. I can't explain Dorian. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
you
but
know
if
what
you
I
go,
mean?
If you go back a few decades, it wasn't like that, was it? Lonnie's argument
Sean Ray, beat people who were bigger than he was.
There you go. And Lila Broderick.
But as long as he came in conditioned enough, and Sean, we're going to point out, is not the tallest bodybuilder who ever walked the stage.
Or the widest.
So, yeah. And and he fought that thing of if he put on too much weight, if he got a little too much bigger, then it blew his symmetry, and he didn't do as well. He finally figured out what the weight it was that he had to come in on.
Right.
You know, so I think that there was a taste for muscle that happened. There are some judges who just love muscle, you know. I once, many years ago, did an article on the judging. I'm pretty sure I interviewed your friend John Calcione and a few others. And what I discovered is, because most of the judges are former competitors, right? They tend to gravitate and like the physiques that are like what their physique was like when they were competing. So if a guy had more of a Frank Zane physique, he's going to like those smaller competitors. But if he was bigger than Arnold, then he's going to like the physique. So people are prejudiced in that way. I think that the, as I say, the taste changed. You know, you had all those years of Dorian and then Ronnie, who was big, but also had some shape to him.
At the beginning.
And then Jay.
He kind of lost it toward the end.
Yeah. Well, that's how Jay, a guy whose genetics for shape was not as good as Ronnie's, was able to beat him. Because it was exactly that thing. Ronnie just wasn't conditioned enough in the right way.
Right.
And Jay came at his best ever, and even though he was a blocky white guy, as Lonnie loves to say, he won. And but when he was not at his peak, the thing is, somebody with better genetics is always going to come along. If you're not perfect in that way, someone's going to beat you.
Yeah.
Just as, when I came into sport, going back to the women, you had Carla, who had been. Carla Dunlap, who had been Miss Olympia, who won that show in Pumping Iron 2. But by the time there were more women, just a bigger gene pool.
Yeah, right.
Coming into it, the fact that Carla's structure wasn't perfect. That's what, you know, by the time I saw Carla on stage, but she was not up to competing with Corey. Just because Corey just had that X frame and just enough muscle to make it beautiful.
Yeah. Well, I think this is a debate that's been going on. I'm reading this book right now called Mr. America, which was written by John Fair. And he goes all the way back to Eugene Sandow's day. And then when bodybuilding competitions first started. And when they started the Mr. America, which is basically what the book is about.
Right.
They kind of compared it to the Miss America, which had just started. This was a male version of the Miss America. And they were trying to pick the ideal American physique. So that's why they had interviews with the guys. They made sure they spoke well. They had good personalities. They looked good. They had a good smile. They judged how their, you know, their facial expression, you know, their face was and everything, their poise, how they walked.
Yeah.
They also judged athletic points. They had to show some kind of athletic background instead of just having just the muscle. And then there started to be a controversy as the show went on, because sometimes you would have a guy who was more muscular, but he wouldn't win because he didn't have all these other qualities. So then they started giving a most muscular award for that guy. But there was a lot there was a lot of those Mr. America shows where a lot of people felt the wrong guy won. So they were always going through, you know, this debate back and forth between the Greek ideal and then the guy who has more muscle. And then when the drugs started getting into it in the 60s, the guy started becoming much, much bigger. And so, you know, this, but then you hear guys like Frank Zane talk or Lee Labrada or Bob Parris was famous for saying this too. Remember when Bob Parris was competing and he had this great frame, over 6 feet tall. And a lot of people were saying, Bob, you could be the next Mr. Olympia, but you got to, I think a lot of, he was saying the judges were telling him, I have to be bigger. I have to be more ripped, but I'm not going to do that because that would ruin the aesthetics of my physique. You know, I can only put on so much muscle where I have the ideal physique for what his version of the ideal physique was. And the judges wanted him to put on more muscle. And Lee Labrada used to say that too. He goes, body, I don't know what this term, he was looking at it like body perfection, you know, and he said, if I put on too much muscle, it'll ruin the lines of my physique and, you know, it'll distort my physique. So these guys had an ideal version of what bodybuilding should be. But a lot of times the judges will go for guys who are just bigger.
And it really, as I say, it depended on the judge.
Mm-hmm.
It depended on the judge. So going back to the women.
Yeah.
So you have Big Steve Weinberger, who is the co-star of Pumping Iron 2, pretty much, becoming more important in the organization, now the number three, pretty much, guy in the NPC IFBB, and he liked muscle. He likes muscle. He's a big muscular guy, and he likes muscular women. He married one, you know?
Right.
So that affected the judging. We know even today, it depends on who the head judge is sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
For the women, if it's Steve or if it's Sandy Rinaldi, just doing a senior moment here on her actual current last name, because I first met her, she was Sandy Rinaldi.
Mm-hmm. But I think in the movie Pumping Iron 2, the debate was, you know, how much muscle are women allowed to build? And I think they sort of brought into this, like you said, the old white men deciding how much muscle a woman should have.
And I said like withered old white men.
Okay,
and I didn't
old,
say withered. White, but they were. I said withered old men, but... And it's just that Ben Leder looked old there. It's not that he was that old.
Right. But then you could have the debate, well, it's the women's choice. They can decide how much muscle they have. But does that ruin the lines of the physique? It's not just a feminine masculine thing, but does it ruin the lines of the physique if they build too much muscle? Because, I mean, there was a point.
Doesn't it? Yeah.
There was a point when women's bodybuilding was extremely popular. Extremely popular. You know, look at the mass media attention it got. Look at how they would fill these auditoriums. And then at a certain point, it lost all that. So,
well, first of all, it depends on the physique.
Somewhere the physiques must have changed.
First of all, it depends on the physique. Second of all, one of the reasons that it became so popular was that women wanted to look like Rachel. And so we have the growth of the sport and the addition of the other divisions. And I can honestly tell you, based on numbers, I'm sure that bikini today brings in many more women than were interested in women's bodybuilding in the 80s. So, and those physiques are beyond anything that those women in the early 80s looked like. You know, I've mixed feelings about it, to be honest.
Well, I mean, before these all these other divisions started, I'm just talking about women's bodybuilding when it started in the 1980s and then where it progressed from there.
Well, but, I mean,
The popularity has to do with Rachel, but Rachel was not muscular. She was not a very big muscular woman. So that means her look was the look that was popular with women who wanted to get into bodybuilding.
Compared to what they looked like, yes. She was muscular compared to them. And they wanted to look like her. And then the sport grew and the women grew. Mm-hmm. And even though there were more, you noticed that as the women bodybuilders got bigger, it created, first of all, the needs for the other divisions. So you get to the point, and you can say the same thing about men's bodybuilding. The bodies grew so much that the actual popularity in terms of being competitors, the women got bigger. They got so big that the general public, it's a big ooh to them.
So don't you think the judges should have said, wait a minute, this is too big. You're too
big. I'm saying that the judges have been debating this among themselves ever since then.
Mm-hmm.
It just kind of creeps up. And I think that they can't help themselves. They love muscle. I don't know if that's the answer.
Mm-hmm.
I just, here's what I know. At Joe Weider's memorial, we had a party, they had a celebration for him. And I interviewed a lot of people. I interviewed Corey. I interviewed Corey Everson, Linda Murray, Rachel McClish, three very popular Miss Olympias from different eras.
Okay.
And I put those up on my little YouTube channel. And to this day, Rachel, these videos are, you have to look for them, or you have to be Googling Rachel and Corey. Rachel has had thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of hits.
Mm-hmm.
The others, not so many.
Right.
That told me how popular Rachel was, even compared to Corey and Linda.
Why do you think that is?
I think it's what you're getting at. You want to say, why did the women get bigger? Because they didn't care what you thought, John. they wanted to get bigger.
Why do you think Rachel was so popular? Because I remember when I was working at Ironman, remember they did that photo shoot with Rachel and she was on the cover, and that issue was super popular.
You know, people have a quality. She was a beautiful woman. She had a beautiful body. She was in the right place at the right time.
Just something that's unique to her. She's just got that it factor.
She had that it factor in a way. Remember, there are many beautiful women, but not all of them does the camera love.
Right, right.
You know, being photogenic is a completely different thing from being pretty.
Yeah.
Or good looking for a guy. I don't mean to make this a...
Yeah.
Just for women. I would also point out that Rachel never became a movie star, even though she's married to a producer.
Yeah, that's true.
Maybe she did not have that to become an actress.
Yeah.
And Corey did not have that to become an actress.
Right.
Or that may just not have been her focus.
Yeah. Well, you even saw that in Pumping Iron 2, where she did that photo shoot for the cover, and then when they showed
then the actress. The cover.
Wow.
Yeah. It's a pop, really, and I remember that cover.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, with Bev, just the personality shines through.
Yeah.
You know, she had more of a lively personality than maybe Rachel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, how much was done up for the show. You know, there's a certain amount of manipulation that went on there, I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm just wondering, you know, if you take women's bodybuilding from how it started in 1980, and it was so popular, if the judges would have been able to keep that look, even though the women got bigger, you know, and I think they could have done it with men's bodybuilding too. I mean, if Dorian would have came into the 94 Olympia, the year he tore his bicep, and Sean Ray looked really good, and they would have taken the title away from Dorian, and he would have said, what happened? And they would have said, well, Dorian, you're just a little too big. Your waist was too big, you know? You got to come in tighter.
They had this thing that they used to say, you really can't just beat the champ, you got to knock him out.
Right.
And that has always existed in men's bodybuilding.
In
women's divisions, it's a lot easier to knock a champ off than the women's. I thought what happened at the Olympia last year was astonishing.
Yeah.
That that Sean was a Roden was able to beat Phil, because sometimes what happens is that they actually look their best the first 2 years, the winners, mm-hmm. the repeat winners. So did Phil actually look as good as he did the first year?
No.
When Sean beat him? I mean, that's your opinion to tell me.
I think Phil looked his best the first couple of years he won the Olympia, if that's what you're asking. I don't think he was at his best the last couple of years.
And I would say that Linda Murray, when she – remember, she won several times, and then she retired, and then she came back. Linda Murray yeah. never looked as good as she did the first year.
Right, right.
During that first run.
Mm-hmm.
So, which is not to say she looked bad,
mm-hmm.
you know. But even when Laura Krivol could not beat her, even though we all thought maybe she should have
yeah.
that 1 year going back. I think, John, that you want to put the genie back in the bottle.
Right.
Literally and figuratively. And the problem is you couldn't.
Right.
I'm
just thinking out loud, what if, you know, what if things would have went differently? Like, for example, I saw Mario Saline, guest host yes. in Chicago. It had to be around 1990, maybe the late mm-hmm. 80s, maybe 1988. And she came out.
I had forgotten that she was around in 83. To do pumping iron, because
yeah.
she was very contemporary to my early years in 86, 87, 88. Yeah.
Yeah. So she came out. She was a guest poser at a show, and she did this amazing routine. I mean, I don't remember very many times in my life, all the bodybuilding shows I've seen and all the bodybuilders I've seen, where I was like sort of taken out of my body. I was swept away. It was just amazing. She got a standing ovation. She just did this really slow moving routine that really showed the beauty of her body. And it was just incredible. It was an incredible sight to see. And I wonder if women's bodybuilding would have continued along that path, if they would have never lost their audience, if they never would have lost their media attention, you know, if it would have kept going along that. And I know it's hard to look back and say that, because like you say, when it starts happening and they start gradually getting bigger and the judges love muscle, how do you not reward it? You know, you got someone.
Go back to that quote from Pumping Iron 2. The guy says to Oscar, say, would you tell a runner to stop running fast?
Right. That's what Charles Gaines was saying. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that is always the thought.
And that's what Lonnie was saying when we were having our discussion. And he was
yeah.
saying things advance. You look at all sports, things advance. The guys get bigger, they get faster, they get stronger. But with bodybuilding, you're talking about an aesthetic appeal. So and then you go back to the Bob Paris, Lee Labrada argument. Too much muscle ruins the aesthetic appeal of the physique. And that's where I think you could make that argument for women's bodybuilding. If they put on too much muscle, it's not just the feminine thing. It's also, did they ruin the aesthetics of their physique? Because I go back to looking at Mario Saline guest posing. I mean, that was just such an incredible display of the female muscular body that I had mm-hmm. never seen it portrayed that way. So it was partly her ability to pose that way and present it, but it was also
yeah.
the physique that she was displaying.
I also look, and just let's get back, let's jump ahead a decade or two.
Mm-hmm.
I look at Iris Kyle, 9-time Miss Olympia.
Right.
From a later era, a lot of women put on a lot of muscle, but they don't have her structure. You understand? Iris looked singularly good.
Mm-hmm.
Her structure, I'm sure there were flaws to pick, but she was a big muscular girl, but her skin was clear, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And once you get into it, okay, if you can get into it, she is beautiful. There are a lot of women, even today, competing Wings of Strength, you know, in the what took over for the Miss Olympia, the World
mm-hmm.
Championship. And they have a lot of muscle and maybe even more muscle than Iris. But they may not look as good as Iris to me.
Right.
Because you have that one person that has that. Just the confluence of factors
mm-hmm.
that come together to make. Why was Corey better? Because the shape, the muscle, the proportion, the taper. She was taller.
The structure, yeah.
She just had it all.
Mm-hmm.
So that women coming along with a little more muscle could not beat her.
Right.
And also, it's maybe true that the judges were holding it back.
Mm-hmm.
Every time the judges come out with new rules for women's bodybuilding or figure or fitness or whichever the division is, and they don't get bigger than this, look like this, every few years they would do that. They would come out with a new set of rules, and it would pull back for a while, you know, and then it would just get unbridled. And that's what seems to happen. And how much of that is because once women start training men and they feel good and, oh, I want more and I want more, and plus I want to win this contest. You know, some of it is, I understand what you're saying, and but you can't hold people back. It's that weird dichotomy.
And in defense of the judges, too, I think a lot of times the crowd wants more muscle. I mean, you can go back to contests like the 1983 Olympia, where Bertil Fox was huge and he only got fifth, and the crowd was going crazy because he only got fifth place. And even that show where Paula Berkenshaw, remember when she lost that Arnold?
Yeah.
And they didn't put her in the top five, and the crowd was going crazy because she had muscle and the crowd wanted muscle. So they were like mad at the judges that they didn't give this girl a higher placing because she had so much muscle.
But the crowd doesn't make the rules.
No.
So, yeah, I can't remember her physique that well.
Mm-hmm.
I think she was real big, right?
But yeah, she was.
Tall. She was not taller. I may be confusing her with another.
Well, she was famous because she came out in her warm-ups when all the other girls were out there for the pose down, and she flipped off the judges. She went up on stage and flipped off the judges, and then the crowd went nuts.
Yeah. That, would you know what year, roughly?
I'd say early 90s. Peter McGuff would know, I'm sure.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure Peter would. I'm sure Peter would. So the problem is you can't put the genie back in the bottle for the men or the women.
Right.
But anybody can train to the degree that he or she wants.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the natural organizations. Tell me, because I don't follow that. How have the physiques changed or stayed the same for the women in the more in the quote-unquote natural organizations?
Well, I would say for the men and the women, the trend for the natural organizations has just been more and more definition, more and more conditioning, to the point where a lot of the guys are just so shredded, but they lose a lot of their muscle. You know,
that's always the problem with a natural athlete.
Yeah,
right?
They can't keep their muscle. So what they're doing is, like my brother made a good point to me. He said these judges are judging drug-like conditioning on a natural physique. They want these guys to show the same kind of conditioning that a guy using drugs would have, but they're natural. And so they want to see the striated glutes. They want to see the striated lower backs. But as a result, because they're natural, they don't have anything to keep the muscle, they end up losing a lot of the muscle, and they come in really kind of skinny, a lot of them. But you have to have that kind of conditioning to even get in the running, you know?
Doesn't it some of that genetic, how much muscle you can put on, how shredded you can get? Isn't that some about to do with your body makeup?
Yeah, sure. For putting on muscle. And I would even say the striated glutes is kind of genetic. I think some people can do that more easily than others. I've seen people show up looking smooth and have striated glutes, you know?
I covered the Team Universe for many years when it was the Team Universe. And Skip LaCour really had that genetics to make to build the muscle. And also to get to diet it, although he had some issues, you know, with that.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to keep it on. And even the guys who are not natural, it's the same thing. You diet down, you lose muscle, right?
Yeah. Well, if you're doing the drugs, it holds on to the muscle, so you don't have a problem as much.
Right, but it still exists.
Oh, yeah.
Somewhat.
Yeah.
So where do you think it's going, John?
I don't know. It just seems like we have more and more divisions now. So now there's a different division for whatever category you want to go into.
Well, the truth is that if you look at the amateur ranks, the divisions that are pulling in more athletes, men's bodybuilding is not the division that's pulling in the most athletes.
No, I think that's going down.
Because people like to look at that, but they don't want to do that.
Right, right.
And I think the same thing for the women, too. Some people like to look at women bodybuilders, some don't. But not everybody wanted to get that big. So there were fewer women coming up in the amateurs. women wanting to get in the sport were going into figure. Now, if they like muscle, they're becoming women's physique, which, as far as I'm concerned, is women's bodybuilding.
Yeah, I agree.
And I'm not saying that in a negative way. I mean, I think that it's, you know, to me, many of them are just as big as the women who are calling themselves bodybuilders now.
Yeah.
But I know, I think it's fabulous that so many people want to compete.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not putting butts in the seat.
Right.
People who are true fans, I can remember sitting, we used to always have VIP seats at the Arnold.
Uh-huh.
So we would be seated surrounded by the people who buy those tickets every year.
Right.
And I can, the Friday night, the women's night, and the fans behind me, the guys, what, they were really into it. It always used to, it was a trip, so mm-hmm. to speak, mm-hmm. to go there and realize that, because I live in two worlds. I live in the bodybuilding world, but I also live in the world that the rest of my life is in.
Mm-hmm.
I live in a world where my liberal friends don't like Arnold. And I work in the world where everybody bows down to Arnold.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty funny sometimes. I have a friend who has literally held me responsible for everything Arnold did as governor, good or bad. I just don't know what to say to him. I say to him, he's whatever you can say about him, he's a man whose old friends have remained loyal, and that says a lot.
Yeah, yeah. But I think Sean Ray made a good point when he was saying he wonders where the future of men's bodybuilding is going because we don't see anybody in the teenage ranks. And I remember when I was a teenager and when Sean was a teenager, the teenage ranks were very filled with a lot of good bodybuilders, which told me that there was a lot of teenagers who wanted to look like bodybuilders. And now,
you don't
have any teenagers competing, not in men's
bodybuilding. Now maybe you have more teenagers who want to do men's physique.
Yeah, you do. But nothing like the numbers we saw when I was younger. I mean, I remember doing the Teenage Mr. Illinois contest. This was AAU back in mm-hmm. 1980, 81, 82. There was literally over 100 teenagers in the show. They had to do it by itself. They couldn't even hold any other contest with it.
I don't know what the numbers for the teen collegiate masters nationals are. That those would be interesting to have those numbers from Gary Udit.
I don't think they're near that.
I haven't been to that show since Men's Physique became popular, so I cannot tell you.
I remember when I had this website called Florida Physique. I was going to all the shows in Florida every weekend.
Right.
And most of the teenage divisions had one or two.
Right.
When I was competing, it was 30 to 50 on average. 30 to
right.
50
and
teenagers every teenage
start,
show.
Women's nationals, there were... It's funny because I have this memory of there being hundreds of people. And mm-hmm. maybe it was, when I go back and look at the old score sheets, it was maybe 30.
Yeah.
So I have this memory. So when I started in 86, the Women's Nationals was its own show.
Right.
In fact, the first one I went to was in Miami. And it was quite a thing. I mean, mm-hmm. it was a big deal. And this is off the pumping iron to reflection and publicity and all the popularity that came on. Women's bodybuilding was big, and then they got to a point where there weren't enough women competing. And this is only a couple of years into it. I'm not talking about 2005. I'm talking about 91, 92.
Right.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually they moved the women in with the men.
Right.
And then,
right.
of course, there's all the divisions starting. I don't know how many teens are doing men's physique, but I'll bet it's a lot.
Hmm. Okay.
I go to the local shows in Southern California, and to be honest, I don't usually get there when the teenagers are up.
Mm-hmm.
I usually get there in time for the pro show, and then I watch a little. But I can tell you there are hundreds and hundreds of young women doing bikini.
Right.
So much so that figure isn't as big as bikini.
Right, right.
I mean, because, you know, fitness came along, and that was a completely different thing with the routines, and that became very popular, and I have this memory of it being extremely popular. And then I look at the numbers, and I compare, and then figure superseded it in popularity, because why do a routine if you didn't have to?
Mm-hmm.
But of course, that's what makes fitness fun.
Right.
I mean, fitness is my favorite division, always has been, because I like to see women do something besides walk on stage in heels. Here comes that feminist again.
Well, going back to my example of seeing Marjo Saline do that incredible pose.
Yeah.
You know,
she was a wonderful posy, but she was never a muscular girl.
Right. So now we have all the women are being drawn to bikini, but they're never going to get a chance to pose like that.
That's unfortunate. It's really too bad. And yet I know someone could speak to you for an hour about the fine art of bikini posing, I'm sure. There's more to it than you think. You know what I'm saying?
It's not going to make that kind of impression.
No. They're just walking and shaking their butts or whatever they're doing. And don't get me in trouble for this.
Right.
But they're not asked to do anything. That's why I don't understand why someone would do figure when she could do women's physique and do a routine.
Well, maybe because they're not muscular enough.
Some of them are close, you know. Mm-hmm.
They don't want to develop the muscle.
Well, women's physique has become pretty popular. I see the numbers at the lineups of the national shows.
Mm-hmm.
See, that's the thing when you say I don't see hundreds of teens the way I did.
Yeah.
What happens for the women, and maybe for the men's bodybuilding too, there's 5 at this show and 6 at that one and 7 at that one. By the time you get to nationals, there's 100 women on stage.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the point Sean was making was back in the day, we used to see a lot of teenagers come up and we could see who the future champions were going to be. Now we don't see any teenagers come up, so you wonder, where's the future?
Sean's a smart guy.
Yeah.
I mean, Sean is absolutely right, but that's been the conversation behind the scenes for a long time. The fact that young men were not becoming bodybuilders, per se.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think there's any shortage of young men working out in the gyms.
No.
Do you see teens in the gym in Florida?
Yeah, I wouldn't call them working out very hard, though. They're more into selfies and doing 10-pound dumbbell curls, you know.
Yeah. Well, 10-pound dumbbell curls for me would be a big thing. What would you like to see happen? I can't help interviewing you. You know, it's my nature. What would you like to see happen to the women? I mean, considering that we can't put the genie back in the bottle.
Yeah, if we can't put the genie back in the bottle, I don't know if there's anything we can do, you know.
You can keep starting divisions and calling them something else.
Right,
and hope
right.
for the best.
Right.
I mean, isn't that what happened?
Yeah, that seems to be what's happening, yeah.
Although there is a point of view that each of those divisions requires a different style of body.
Mm-hmm.
This wellness that's coming up. Do you know? You probably know more about it than I do.
Yeah, I don't know much. I know it was popular in like South America and stuff, so they're going to bring it over here to the United States. So we'll see what happens with that.
Well, I look at the bodies going back to what you said, because I saw some pictures a couple of years ago, and then I've seen some pictures that are being shown now.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand this is essentially a fitness model contest.
Yeah.
And it is really meant for women who have a more genetic predisposition to
big butts.
Big butts, yes.
Right.
Well, let's, you know, and as someone who had chicken fat thighs my whole life, but not like the South America women. I mean, you watched all those women who've come from South America come into the mainstream organization, whether they were figure. I think about Juliana Malacarne when she was doing figure, how she couldn't get arrested. Because if you've got a natural butt like that,
right,
which I think most people would agree is a fairly attractive thing, if you're going to try to diet down to those standards to get your butt hard or you get your butt ripped or whatever, that's not really a smart health move, right?
Right.
I mean, you're going to have to do extreme dieting. And I think that's why wellness seems to be very popular, because what I saw in the pictures is that there was some definition in their arms, but their lower half is not soft by any means, but not ripped.
Yeah.
So that seems to be, I mean, we're going to find out. They're going to say, here's what it should be, and here's the person
you're
going to want to look like. I don't think it's going to take off in Minnesota.
We'll never know. We'll see.
We'll see.
All right, Ruth. Well, thank you for joining me on the show. We had an interesting discussion about women's bodybuilding. It was interesting getting your perspective from when the sport started, basically, in the 1980s or when it was at its peak. So it was good to hear from you about that.
I don't think that we've lost the peak of women working out, and that's the really important thing.
Oh, yeah, I agree with you. I think more and more people are into it now, into training.
Look at how many more women are in the gyms.
Mm-hmm.
Even if I go to, like, LA Fitness or whatever, there's women working out seriously.
Yeah, very serious. I see in my gym, the younger women are working out harder than the younger men.
But they're not attracted to competition, is that correct?
No, I think a lot of them are competing or training for that. I think that's why they're so serious.
So the question is the popularity among athletes to compete, which mm-hmm. is not the same thing as the popularity as a spectator sport to put strangers coming to put butts in the seat.
Right, right.
So I think we can safely say that bodybuilding is as popular as ever or even more so for women.
Yeah.
Competing as a bodybuilder in the bodybuilding division,
mm-hmm.
not so popular.
No. But more the bikini and the figure.
Right. But those numbers are huge.
Yeah, yeah. Especially the bikini. That's most of the girls I see working out seriously in the gym are training for bikini.
Well, there's no end to women who want, because it's, you know, it's sporting, it's a sport, but they're feeling sexy, you know, they're in heels,
yeah.
They're sashaying around the
stage. They're healthier, yeah, for sure. It's definitely a positive.
There you go. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for having me, John.
Well, thank you, Ruth. It was great talking to you, and maybe we can have you on the show again. It's always good to have a discussion with you.
I've enjoyed it very much. It went beyond where I thought it was going to go, so that's great.
Maybe we'll have you and Lonnie on to have a debate.
Oh, that could be
fun. Back the old Iron Man.
I hope I get to see you in person again soon.
Yeah, hopefully I'll be out in California one day soon. I'll let you know.
Okay, thanks a lot, John.
All right, take care. All right, thank you for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast. And I want to thank my sponsors, Old School Labs, for sponsoring this episode of the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast. And without further ado, here we go. This is going to be a great article. You guys are going to love it. It came from the January 1978 issue of Iron Man magazine. And this, of course, is the original Iron Man magazine that was published by Perry and Mabel Rader. It was kind of the smaller magazine. It's not a regular 8.5 by 11. So it was a unique magazine in that way. But people who were around during this time really, really loved this magazine. Chet Yorton is on the cover, and this had to be from 1977. And on the back cover, they always had a picture on the front cover and the back cover. These were full-page pictures. On the back cover is Bertel Fox looking huge. And this is early Bertel Fox from 1977, or maybe even 1976. All right, so here's the article. It's called Zane Wins Mr. Olympia. It's written by Roger Schwab, and on the left side of the page is a great picture of Zane doing a hands-on hip most muscular taken by Karen Clark. And on the other side is a picture of Robbie Robinson doing a kneeling side chest pose. That picture is by Barry, it says. All right, here we go. It says, make no mistake about it, the 1977 version of the Mr. Olympia contest was the finest produced and the most intensely competitive in the distinguished series of this unparalleled event, inaugurated in 1965. Gone were the two-man duels of the past Olympias, Scott's devastating defeat of Poole in 1965, Sergio's last decision over Arnold in 1969, Arnold's dethroning of Oliva in 1970, the Essen controversy in 1972, Nubre's demise in 1973, Arnold's conquest of Louis and Franco in the Battle of the Giants at Madison Square Garden and Pretoria. With Arnold's departure, a new era was created. It premiered in 1976 when the heir apparent to the crown, Franco Colombo, nipped a finely perfected Frank Zane to become the first post-Arnold Mr. Olympia. Franco's subsequent retirement, consummated by knee surgery resulting from a serious spill, left the 1977 Mr. Olympia without a reigning champion. No less than 5 of the 9 entered competitors, and maybe 1 or 2 more, arrived in Columbus, Ohio this October 1st with the anxiety that anything less than a first place would be a crushing defeat. This is where our story begins. Though the prospect of judging this historical competition was a thrill only few experience, the decision that ultimately had to be decided proved to be an agony that just might not justify the honor. I'll now try to recreate the impressions of the event and the competitors who made it happen. Some 3,500 enthusiasts, very loud enthusiasts, had filled the Veterans Memorial Auditorium in Columbus, Ohio, for the prejudging of the 1977 Mr. Olympia. Producers of the show, Misters Lorimer and Schwarzenegger, had refined an almost flawless event last year, and it was acknowledged that both prejudging and the show itself had been sold out for quite some time. The scene was thus set. It did not take a genius to suspect that what was about to transpire would be the essence of the art and sport of bodybuilding. It was announced that judging would be based on the muscularity, symmetry, and presentation of the competitors. That is merely a surface explanation about what judging the greatest physiques in the world is all about. The IFBB has organized a scoring system which is accurate and fair beyond a doubt. I participated in this system, learned from it, and valued it in making my final decision. At the prejudging, the decision-making process is accomplished in 3 rounds: standing relaxed, compulsory posing, and optional posing. These 3 rounds are viewed individually and comparatively by the judges. Points, 20 maximum for each round, are awarded to a competitor in each of the 3 rounds and added for the overall total. The finale would be a pose down of the top 3 men in each class at the conclusion of the evening show, the winner being chosen at that time in front of the audience. Thus, when the audience arrived in the evening of the show, the top 3 in each class had been selected. However, the overall winner had not yet been chosen. I will not dwell on the introduction of the competitors, which was emceed by the highly respected Reg Park. As last year, the men were silhouetted in their most well-known pose and welcomed buoyantly by their fans. Frank Zane, runner-up 1976 Mr. Olympia, was first to appear. Zane possesses the flowing lines and shape of muscle, which immediately set him apart from any other competitor. Tonight was the finest I've seen him. This man has been a champion since 1968, his IFBB Mr. America win. Every body part is a strong point. Tremendously detailed back and striated lumbar area. His legs, though not large, have nearly perfect shape and proportion. His posing routine, of course, is polished and displays the Zane physique to its apex. Most of his posing routine emphasizes his torso and abdominal development with arms away from the body or overhead. His presentation this night is ended with a clenched fist overhead. The pressure of the event weighed heavily upon Frank Zane. He had seemed more hyper on stage this year than before. The usual calm Zane facade was but a surface for a cauldron of emotion just beneath. He knew this must be his year. He had peaked exactly on this October evening. This was the zenith of the Zane physique, all that he could offer of himself. When Bill Grant followed Zane, I could tell upon first sight that he showed tremendous improvement of the 1976 Olympia. Grant was more muscular and he seemed heavier than before. Photographer John Balick later mentioned that Grant was the heaviest 188-pounder to date. Grant seemed assured with his improvement when he first appeared. However, as was last year, he failed to create the excitement that his development deserves. I heard an enthusiast directly behind me comment on Grant's lack of calf development. I found it hard to believe that someone could isolate that deficiency on an otherwise staggering, intensely muscular physique. Grant's calves are high and short, a genetic reality. However, Bill Grant did seem to lose confidence in his search for glory as his posing routine waned to a close. I had never seen Albert Beckles in person before this contest, and part of his posing routine, so indigenous to himself, I shall not forget. Beckles' physique is, in a sense, the antithesis of the Zane physique, like slabs of thick muscle indiscriminately placed upon his frame. What is non-existent in fine lines is counterbalanced by heavy, hard development from head to toe. His arms are more impressive than his pictures, if that's possible. He throws one pose where his arms are brought down by his sides and twisted in a way which outlines the most muscular delts and pecs of the entire show. Beckles has been in the international limelight for nearly a decade, and he appeared sharper this evening than in the days of his Great Britain and Universe wins. His sixth-place finish reinforces the heretofore unparalleled standards of the 1977 Olympia. Unquestionably, the showstopper of the evening performance was 44-year-old Ed Corney. Corney, in a two-minute posing routine, unlike anything seen before in physique competition, created a legend. In what was, to my eyes, the finest presentation ever delivered in the art of physique display, Ed Corney nearly stole the 1977 Mr. Olympia contest. Hopefully, when Wide World of Sports replays the competition on TV in January, they will be able to recreate the magnitude of all that unbelievable scene. 3,500 people shouting, Corney, Corney, uncontrollable, nearly charging the stage. It's difficult to try to write this in true perspective. For the record, I placed Corney fourth overall, 1 point behind Boyer Coe. The overall scoring had Corney third, 1 point ahead of Coe. In the lineup, relaxed, Corney definitely did not stand out. His was a finished physique, but I felt my scoring was accurate. At least two of my colleagues informed me later that they had awarded Corney first place. One thing is for sure, if Corney had been announced overall winner, there would have been no verbal abuse from the crowd. At 44, Ed Corney had become a superstar. To my mind, this evening must have been a most frustrating disappointment for Boyer Coe. I saw Boyer 6 weeks earlier guest posting at the Eastern USA Championships. My reflection of that performance led me to believe that he would be very difficult for anyone to defeat. Hesitantly, the conjecture might be that Coe had peaked slightly too soon. Whatever, he was definitely superior to last year, and if he was not at his very best of a month ago, he was near it. He had the best upper and lower body balance in the contest, along with Ken Waller. Let me interject here that a judge's obligation is to select a winner as purely objectively as possible. When compared to a physique such as Coe or Robinson to Frank Zane or Ed Corney, this objectivity becomes merely a word. These are unbelievable physiques, unparalleled yet so structurally opposite. I must wonder if selecting a best physique in this case is not a futile responsibility and necessitating ultimate subjectivity. And so it passes that an unbelievably muscular Boyer Coe finishes in fourth place in a competition which he justifiably believed he could win. Robbie Robinson was first of the over 200-pound Olympia competitors. He was, of course, the pre-contest favorite, and he did not disappoint. Robbie was apparently heavier than I had seen him and nearly as sharp. A past criticism had been the absence of a personable, charismatic posing routine. Tonight, Robbie was a showman. There was no three or four poses and splitting the scene this night. The routine was longer, more creative, and artistic than before. It did not take long for Robinson to know that the 1977 Mr. Olympia was the fight of his life. Though Corney's posing had created a near riot, Robbie figured that the final confrontation would be between himself and Frank Zane. So it was that during the final pose-off of the Mr. Olympia contest, Robbie Robinson, in unprecedented style, evacuated his position in the center of the competitors and brushed his way next to Frank Zane. Here was the real battle of the night, as each man posed with almost hyper-intensity. Almost ignored in this most thrilling finale was Ken Waller, fulfilling a promise to enter this event in his finest condition. Waller was uneasily accepted his role as the villain. This role was created in several scenes from Pumping Iron, where Waller plays the antagonist of gentle giant Mike Katz. Live tonight, Waller must have been somewhat shaken by the boos that greeted his presence, although he seemed to smilingly shake them off. He looked good, more vascular than before, with excellent symmetry and the best calves in the show. From some angles, however, his abdominals showed strain of his varying body weights, and his hips appeared somewhat broader than the others. Thus, there was no fury when Ken placed down the list overall in fifth position. Questionable defeats in his past did not deter him from annexing the Mr. America, Mr. World, and Mr. Universe crowns. Hopefully, this setback will not shake the foundations of his final goal. Dennis Tinerino and Roger Walker rounded out the competition and were admittedly, unlike the others, not in their finest shape. I saw Tinerino in the 1975 Pro Mr. Universe in Los Angeles in his most fantastic appearance. If Dennis had retained that form, he he would have been a threat this night. Roger Walker appeared lighter in body weight and whiter in skin color than at last year's Universe competition, where he won the heavyweight division. He was never a threat in this Mr. Olympia. A deep tan would enhance the appearance of Walker's physique immensely. He had the potential to be very impressive. The top three from each class appeared in the final posedown: Zane, Corny, and Coe in the under 200, and Robinson, Waller, and Tinarino in the over 200. After it was over, Frank Zane was announced Mr. Olympia 1977 by MC Reg Park. Robinson, Corny, Coe, Waller, and Tinarino followed in that order. There will always be differences of opinion and reflective hindsight. Probably any of the first five could have won, but the real glory of the event was the many creative firsts that occurred. Beginning with the unparalleled organization and production to Corny's historical presentation, Zane's clenched fist salute, and Robinson's pose down confrontation. It was a tremendous task to judge this event. It was worth the agony. And then at the end of the article, they have the placings. Mr. Olympia under 200, Frank Zane, first place with 279 points. Ed Corny in second with 270 points. Boyer Coe, as he mentioned, in third place, 1 point behind with 269. Albert Beckles had 250 points, and Bill Grant had 244 points. And then the over 200-pound class, Robbie Robinson took first with 278 points, 1 point behind Zane. Ken Waller got second with 263 points. Dennis Tinarino took third with 239 points. And Roger Walker from Australia was fourth with 236 points. And then the overall, Frank Zane was first, Robbie Robinson second, Ed Corny third, Boyer Coe fourth, Ken Waller fifth, and Dennis Tinarino sixth. The judges were Reg Park from South Africa, Bill Drake from the USA, Abdel Giyundi from Egypt, Albert Busack from Germany, Jacques Blumhardt from Belgium, Roger Schwab, who also wrote the article, from the USA, and Winston Roberts from Canada. The MCs were Len Boslin and Reg Park. And then they also have the results of the Mr. International, which also took place that night. In the lightweight class, Mohamed Makaway from Egypt with 271 points, Jorma Ratti from Finland with 256 points, Ray Hilligan from Canada, 225 points, and Larry Champagne from Canada with 206 points. In the middleweights, Walter Bubenicek from Austria with 262 points, Samir Banout from Lebanon in second place with 246 points, Erling Wahlgren from Sweden, 244 points, Dave Mastorakis from the USA, we've had Dave on the show before, 235 points, Kevin McNamara from South Africa, 234 points in fifth place, Ulf Bengtsson from Sweden, 229 points in sixth place, Franklin Green from the USA, 222 points in seventh, George Payne from the USA, 215 points in eighth, Raymond Sanssouci from Canada, 209 points. Ian Monroe from Canada, 201 points. And then in 11th place, Rock Honey from the USA with only 147 points. In the heavyweight class, Roy Callender from Canada, 268 points. Ben Herder from Holland in second with 245. Kent Keane, the late Kent Keane, he just passed away this last weekend, from the USA with 240 points in third place. Ferds Barazi from Syria with 214 points, and Ray Riley from the USA with 210 points. And, of course, McAway beat Callender in a very close decision, and you can see here McAway scored 271 points and Callender 268. So when they compared them for the overall, McAway was the winner. What a great event. I was at that show. I'll never forget it. And what a great job by Roger Schwab. Great article. So, guys, I have a lot more articles to share with you because I've got a ton of Ironmans. I grabbed about 30 of them, stuffed them in my suitcase on the way home. So I got a lot more great articles to share with you guys over the next few months. And next week, we will have our second anniversary special. So I will be taking clips from the last year, some of my favorite interviews that we did over the last year, and we're going to play them for you next week on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast as we celebrate our second anniversary. All right, thanks again to Old School Labs for sponsoring this episode. Have a great 4th of July, everybody. Take care.